Okay. To business. So these rambles are under the heading of The Death of God and the Hell of Atheism. And I launched off yesterday with an introduction to the topic, which I will very briefly summarise and probably say something completely different to what I said yesterday. So, as probably is quite widely known, that the death of God was announced by Nietzsche in a number of his works, especially in the so-called Gay Science, and Zarathustra too. And what he seemed to mean is that God no longer can work as a cultural force, at least in general Western culture. Maybe something that individuals experience and feel for and use as a part of the vocabulary of their experience. But as a cultural force, it can no longer work. At that time, he said that people hadn't woken up to this, but it's happened. And, in the Middle Ages, for instance, everything would have been related to God. And all public events would be directly connected with God in one way or another. It's just not realistic anymore. I think the House of Commons opens with prayers, but I doubt if many of the honourable members pay much attention. It really just isn't, especially in a country like Britain, which is probably more radically secularised than most. It just isn't a binding cultural force, notwithstanding the fact that there are many people who have very strong theistic convictions. And Nietzsche foresaw that this death of God would lead to an increasing loss of values, a loss of a sense of higher values, and that without the underpinning of God — he didn't exactly regret this, by the way — but without the underpinning of God, then values have nothing to sustain them. And he foresaw, for Western culture, an increasing nihilism, which he saw as, a disaster, ultimately a disaster. Notwithstanding that, he considered that it was very necessary for us to truly face up to the death of God. Because if we really faced up to it, and faced up to the crisis that it brought to our culture, to our civilization, we had the possibility of something new, of something that would found values on more basic human experience. So I started to address that by pointing to the Buddha's own discussion of the two extremes of cultural belief, you could say. The extreme of eternalism, which believes that all our experience is related to an absolute metaphysical existent, whether that's conceived in personal terms, a personal God, or conceived of as a principle that lies outside what we experience moment by moment, that the ever-changing flow of experience outside that, beyond that, or inside it, or some other metaphorical relationship to it, there lies a reality that is eternal, unchanging, abiding. Of course, all sorts of complications arise in how we relate to that, because if it's something that's eternal and unchanging, how can we ever know it, we being changing? If we come into relationship with it, we modify it. You got me? We won't go into all the logical conundrums that pass on from there. So on the one hand, he said there's eternalism. And eternalism, he argued, leads to the idea that you must subordinate your humanness to that eternal reality, however you conceive it, so that you must, in effect, suppress or at least control your human faculties in one way or another. You know, the most extreme example is, you know, the kind of late Protestant idea of the sinfulness of sex and the suppression of those sort of emotions because God disapproves. Very crude way of thinking, which of course there's much more sophisticated versions of. So eternalism leads to an attitude to yourself, which is that you are, so to speak, insignificant and must suppress yourself. Hugely crude explanations of very complex and diverse modes of response. But it leads to a view of ethics as concerned with your relationship with these ultimate verities. On the other hand, you have nihilism. And the essence of nihilism is that there is no real meaning to things. They don't amount to anything. They don't add up to anything. I suppose in modern terms we could describe it as materialism, the idea that there's simply an interplay of a neutral, impersonal forces which have somehow or other created you know, this temporary concatenation, me, and which in time will just pass away. But it's, from any larger perspective, meaningless. So your human existence is really just a kind of play of light, which has no larger validity, no larger value. According to him, nihilism, the belief that there was no ultimate reality, no ultimate meaning, no ultimate reality, or that the ultimate reality was nothingness, the result of that was simply grabbing for whatever pleasure you could get, as I put it yesterday, till the curtains come down, the lights go out. You just use the space that you've got in life to get as much happiness as you can, as much pleasure as you can, and you know, when you check out, you check out, and that's it. And you can see that if you really did believe that life had no meaning, that there were no value inherent in it, well, your only guide for behaviour is the maximisation of your own pleasure, often fairly narrowly conceived. So the Buddha saw human action, human existence, as sort of poised between these two poles. And he believed that both these poles had very deleterious consequences for human existence. I've already mentioned on the ethical level, eternalism leads to an oppressive, self-oppressive and other-oppressive behaviour. If you believe in an eternal verity, then you will be inclined to force yourself and force others to honour that eternal verity. That may even mean that you're prepared to torture, to ultimately to kill those who do not observe it. And European history, no doubt, world history is littered with the bodies that have come from that. That sort of eternalism leads to all kinds of oppressive structures. I'm very familiar with this in India, where the caste system is validated by eternalist views. In Europe, all the wars of religion have come from competing perspectives on those eternalist views. But the Buddha said at least they have some degree of morality, even if it's misguided, at least there is some sort of idea of what is better than something else. Nihilism, at its most extreme, is psychopathic, you could say, sociopathic. It really is everybody for themselves. It's simply doing what you can to enjoy yourself, get your pleasures while you can. I suppose you get something of this with somebody like Raskolnikov. It's a very complicated question, but exactly what Dostoevsky was talking about. He's talking about something like that sort of nihilism. So for the Buddha, these were the two poles on which people guide their lives. He connected them also with ideas about what happened after death. So the eternalist believes, according to the Buddha, that there is something in us that is unchanging, that we have in Sanskrit and parlance, an Atman in Pali, the Buddha's own language, or close to the Buddha's own language, an Anta. A self, not in the ordinary empirical sense of who do you mean, me, but in the sense of some part of me that stands outside the flow of my experience and that somehow owns it, again, in a rather mysterious way. A very complicated logic that gets involved here. Soul in the Western tradition captures part of it, although soul also has a rather more poetic I think useful meaning. But soul as a metaphysical particle that is indestructible, that through all the changes of time remains unchanged, an immortal soul. So eternalism goes with a view of our sort of metaphysical psychic reality, that there is something about us that is always outside change, and that is the most important thing about us. Very complicated, complex views about the relationship of that inner soul, so to speak, with the outer absolute reality come about. So the eternalist view is connected with the idea that at death, this eternal particle of selfhood endures and either passes into a new body or passes on to a new stage of existence. Nihilism is the reverse of all that. Yes, it's the idea that there is no ultimate value. There's no ultimate meaning. It's the idea that ethics has no foundation. There's no foundation to values. So what you will is the whole law. To quote Aleister Crowley, that great precursor to Buddhism in the West. It's a whole other issue. That on the level of individual existence, when death comes, that's it. Nothing goes on afterwards. So he connected these three elements, the sort of metaphysical perspective, the psychological and the ethical. And he considered that all these arose out of a false reading of our experience, that we break up the flow of our experience, identify the aspect of that flow, which is things appearing, and absolutize it. Huh? So that you take the fact that things come into existence, they appear to come into existence, and you read that as the reality of things. Coming into being is what life is all about. So then you read that on the grandest scale. You say that on the absolute scale, there is an existence, which is the reality that underlies everything. You argue that in me, there is an existent that stands outside the changes of things and that will perdure. And then that provides the foundation for ethics and cultural values and so forth. The nihilist, on the other hand, absolutizes the experience of things fading away. You can see that even just on the narrow scale of your own experience. You have a really bad set of experiences. Frequently it's connected with a lot of death, where people very dear to you dies. You know, sometimes I've encountered that with people when they have two or three deaths in the family, of two or three people close to them die. And they easily then sort of take that experience of death, and it becomes their whole psychological weather. The clouds set in. This is life. It's death. That's what it's all about. So you've taken an experience, which undoubtedly is a painful one, and you've read that as somehow everything. So you've taken the experience of dying, the experience of passing out, and you've made that into a big metaphysical idea of nothingness. Just the same way, if you know everything goes well for you and things happen, and you know you see a child coming into existence and so forth, you gain the idea of existence, independent of thing, as something that's sort of independent of things coming into existence. Do you see what I mean? You experience things coming into existence, then you think existence. Actually, you can never experience existence, and you can never experience nothingness. Those are just ideas that we derive from our experience and then impose upon ourselves, absolutize, form grand theories, build temples and blah blah blah, write long books that become sacred and so forth, and erect into cultural and social structures that are decide who's in and who's out, that provide status and meaning for a social structure. So we absolutize from our ordinary experience grand ideas that then become oppressive. They support us to some extent, of course. Why would we take them up otherwise? But they also oppress us, or they oppress others. So the Buddha said, come on, chaps, let's come down to what actually happens. What happens is that we have an experience of things flowing, arising in dependence on conditions. When those conditions pass away, they merge into new sets of conditions out of which new things arise. That's what we actually experience. You know, I mentioned yesterday we experienced our arrival here, or maybe you experienced ramble starting, Subhuti putting on his boots and starting to walk, so that something began to come into existence, and your participants in this, it's part of your actual experience. You're hearing the sound waves hitting your ears, having certain resonances or counter resonances within you, whatever, and all of that is just sort of going on. But at the same time, we're having to organize our experience. Otherwise, it's unintelligible to us. So, as we saw yesterday, we break it up into little bits. And those bits, little bits, make it possible for us to work with it, organize it. But then we get fixed on the little bits into which we've organized things. And we think those little bits are reality, rather than the abstractions, the abstractions that we make in order to handle this unending flow of experience, conditioned arising. So the Buddha said, let's come back to that. That's the middle way between eternalism and nihilism. There's an arising, there's a passing away. Every moment of arising is simultaneously a moment of passing away. In order for this event to commence, an empty room had to pass away and a full room thereby came into existence, if you see what I mean. This, the Buddha said, is applicable at every moment, every step, every stage, everything. As things arise, well, they're not really things, actually. They're temporary conditions that pass into other conditions. So I said, if we attend to this, we can find our freedom, because we can examine that flow of conditions, and we can see the conditions that lead us to the greater fulfillment, you could say. I was going to say happiness, but happiness is far too limited. It's really to our greater fulfillment. If you take up the eternalist point of view, at its worst, it's really hell today in so that you can have jam tomorrow. If you take up the nihilist point of view, it's jam today so that you have hell tomorrow. what the Buddha argued was that there are flows, there are conditioned arisings, that if you study them, if you learn about them, will lead to your own mind, your own experience arising in a more fulfilling way. Most importantly of all, they will lead to your experience arising in such a way that it's no longer fixated on I. It's no longer constantly oriented back to me. It's as if you break free of the constrictions of self-clinging, is the way he would put it. You no longer focus your experience on your self-concern. And that letting go of self-concern, he argued, is freedom, is fulfillment, and is, of course, peace. So the whole Buddhist life is focused on leading us to the point at which we let go of self-clinging, so that we, by a process of conditioned arising, we enter a state of mind in which we're no longer fixated on I. So, I'm going to now just focus a little bit in on this idea of self-fixation, so that we can better understand what it means to go beyond it. Because what I'm really going to try to get at is that it's that going beyond that ultimately is the middle way between eternalism and nihilism, that progression of more and more selfless states is what lies between eternalism and nihilism. So let's look first of all at what it is that we're trying to deal with. So what the Buddha really is saying is that the way in which we organize our experience is not a way that is adequate to that experience. It's not a way that's guaranteed to bring us happiness. It's not a way that's guaranteed to create harmony with others. So how do we organize our experience? Well, we organize it, as I've said, by breaking it up into bite-sized munches, by dividing it up into intelligible wholes, so that we break up the undifferentiated flow of things into discrete knowables, which aren't really there, but which we think into our experience so that we can manage our experience. And one of the most fundamental of those abstractions from our experience is I. We organize our experience into what belongs to me and what doesn't belong to me. And brothers and sisters, we're all doing this, well, can't say I know into all of your minds, but I think it's very, very likely that right this moment, that's exactly where we're all at. We're all looking at this situation from our own point of view. And subtly at the back of our looking at it from our own point of view is a concern with our own interests. You know, it's fair enough, it's okay. I don't blame you for it. I'm doing it too. You know, I'm talking, I'm trying to explain the Buddha's teaching, and I've got aspirations to serve the truth. But frankly, I'm really concerned that you all think I'm really clever and wonderful. Okay, I'm doomed, I know. But, you know, the back of my mind, I'd really like you all to like me. Think, what a nice guy. What a humble guy, you know, because he's telling us all about his self-clinging. Oh, gosh, I'm getting into circularity here. Of course I want to impress you. You know, at the same time, I do have some real concern with truth somewhere in the middle of it all. I do have some concern with communicating the Dhamma to you. I hope enough to, you know, not get too much in the way. And it's the same for everybody else. We're all, you know, you're all listening to what I'm saying and you're referring it back to yourself. It's got what you've got to do. And you're trying to sort of see how this works for you, what effect it has on you. You know, you're probably thinking, you know, some sort of thoughts about how it relates to you. There may be quite extraneous thoughts about, you know, is... did my new haircut work? I don't have to worry about that, but you know what I mean. Sort of, we're all mildly self-infatuated. Some of us not even mildly. A subtle or not so subtle self-concern is there all the time. It's quite natural, and it's how we got here. It's how this extraordinary civilization that we occupy has come into being by. You know, animals, organisms that were all, you know, gradually selected under, you know, Darwinian principles and Darwinian processes were selected for survival. And out of that selection for survival, well, the really effective tool of survival is the ability to think I. Because when you can think I, you can begin to plan. You can begin to plan I in the future. You know, you see animals, they sort of live in an undifferentiated now. Upstairs in Samagavasa, and a little dog ran in. Community members these days aren't what they used to be. We had some animals in our time, but not And, you know, the little dog just running around from, you know, looking for the next person to pat it or looking where there was something to eat or looking for a post. And completely intoxicated with the unending flow of smells. So there's no sort of, no purpose. It didn't stride in thinking, I'm going to go and see the chairman of the... it couldn't do that. Well, you know... I don't know that dog very well, so. As a sense perception achieved a certain sophistication, began to be possible to differentiate or to abstract, especially with the development of language, and to thereby have an idea about the future, to learn from the past, to. Think of situations that might be, to have wishes, desires. Extremely important tool of evolution. You know, without it, we couldn't ever even think of, for instance, meditating. Because you can think, I would like to be whatever you'd like to be through meditation, calmer, wiser, whatever. Then you can organise yourself to get yourself to a Buddhist centre and learn meditation. If you had no idea of I, you couldn't do that. So it's an extremely valuable tool. And, you know, the looking after ourselves, the caring for ourselves is itself a very, very powerful tool of human evolution. It's actually, the Buddhists argued, effectively, it's where our life in the Dhamma starts. It starts with our concern for ourselves. If you weren't concerned for yourselves and for your own happiness and fulfillment, why bother to come to a meditation centre and sit with your eyes closed and your legs crossed, trying to count your breath? Silly thing to do. Go out and have fun, for goodness sake. Because you care about yourself, which is a healthy thing to do, you start to act in ways that develop yourself under the law of karma, in Buddhist terms. There's a law that governs mental functioning, so that when you make a skillful effort, your mind develops. When you try to develop metta, as some of us did at the beginning, you feel different. You can even feel as if you're seeing a different world. So this self-reference is very, very valuable. And I think it would be highly unfortunate if people thought of a self as something bad or wrong. It does have to be transcended, because it is the source of our problems. This self-identification, whilst it can be what drives us to follow a Dhamma life, is what leads to our reactivity, our unskillful behaviour, the harm that we do, the violence in the world. All emerges out of that self-clinging, when our self-clingings come into competition. So this self-clinging, this self-interest, this self-identification is both a very, very positive development and a positive key to the future, and a very destructive and limiting force in our minds. And our Dhamma lives are lived to transcend it. We're practicing the Dhamma to arrive at a state of mind which is not merely focused on I. It's not that, you know, as a human being, you're never going to get rid of that notion, because it's part of the whole basic structure of what it is to be a human being. You'll continue to be able to say, I am Subhuti, and I would like my breakfast. You're going to be able to still continue to interact on that sort of basis. You no longer take it as having ultimate validity. So, huge number. I've said so many things, I've even slightly confused myself. But what I'm getting at is that this self-identification is the source of our future development. It's what drives us to practice the Dharma, and it is what the Dharma ultimately leads us beyond. The Dharma leads us to an experience that arises within us, and it's not of something else, but it's of a state of mind which is not focused back on I. So that you experience yourself operating within the world, and you're sort of free from that circling back on I. I've been thinking about this a lot recently. I've just written an article about all this, which will hit the newsstands very soon, I hope. But in that, I referred to an experience that our own teacher talks about, which very, very strongly illustrates this. I did talk about this, I think, last time I was here, but I'll mention it again. He, Sangharakshita, as you know, probably know, lived in India for 20 years. He's English, but he lived in India for 20 years. And he was a monk to begin with, and then, he went to study Buddhism and practiced up in the Himalayas. But he became involved with the movement of conversion amongst those who'd been considered untouchable in the Hindu caste system. Many of them moved into Buddhism as a way out of their caste status and their self-identification as untouchables. And they did this under the leadership of a very great modern Indian who's not so widely known as he should be, Dr. Ambedkar, who wrote the Indian Constitution. Anyway, that's another whole story. But Sangha actually became involved with Dr. Ambedkar's work. And after the great mass conversion, when 400,000 people converted in the Indian city of Nagpur, where Amoga City comes from, sitting there in the red, that's his very city, Dr. Ambedkar died just 6 weeks later. It's a huge shock for his people. And Sangha Rakshita, by a strange coincidence, arrived in Nagpur on that day, on the very day that news of Dr. Ambedkar's death arrived. And, you know, you can imagine, for these people, Dr. Ambedkar really was a saviour. I don't mean in the religious sense. He was their social saviour. He completely changed their social outlook and their view of themselves. It's a huge revolution that he launched, which, you know, is effective. You can see it in the statistics. People have completely changed their lives as a result of that conversion. And Sangha Rakshita arrived in Nagpur to find people devastated. It's probably not too strong a word. Their great leader had gone. Most of them are illiterate. Probably Amoga City's grandparents would have been there. They were probably illiterate. They'd have been landless labourers who came into Nagpur to get away from the horrible position in the villages. And, you know, things were pretty tough in the towns as well. And Dr. Ambedkar, an utterly incorruptible and very highly principled, extremely intelligent leader, himself coming from that background, had showed them a better future. Before they'd really had a chance to take hold of it for themselves, he'd gone. So the people in that city, and there were probably a million or so of them, completely distraught, just weeping, weeping, weeping. What to do? What to do? I told this story actually just last year when Moga City was translating for me, and I was sort of telling the story like this, and people in the audience were weeping as I spoke. They were remembering what it was like at that time, just that feeling of utter hopelessness. So Sangha Rakshita found himself having to try to rally people, he said that in 3 days he gave more than 30 talks. And a talk in India is not just a 40-minute ramble. It's 2 or 3 hours. And he would just go from slum to slum, just speaking about, you know, Dr. Ambedkar's message, how it didn't die with him, how they had to carry it on. And a few days later, he wrote to a friend, and he spoke very, very simply and eloquently, saying that my whole experience during this time was most peculiar. This was in 1956, so perhaps peculiar meant something slightly different. And he said, I felt that I was an impersonal force. I found myself working often without any thought. Get up to give a talk, no thought, but exactly the right words would come out of his mouth. He said, as if I was in meditation, in deep samadhi. And he said that by the time he left, after 3 days of what would normally be exhausting work, he felt refreshed and stimulated. So that's, I think, what is meant. Of whether, you know, what happened after that, let's not say. But at that time, he experienced himself letting go of self. He wasn't thinking about himself. There was a very, very strong need. He'd got all the training, all the background, all the understanding, and the deep feeling just to respond to people's needs. And without any need to reflect, without any need to plan, whatever was needed just flowed out of him. This is what we mean, at least this is a taste of what we mean by this transcendence of self. Whether that was temporary or not, that's not our concern. But for a while, at least, he experienced himself as functioning beyond self-clinging, beyond self-concern. Maybe this is not so uncommon. There are moments, probably, when many of us have at least some lift beyond ourselves, when we're no longer thinking about ourselves. And not just in the sense that we're intoxicated with love, because that's just a sort of form of sort of expanded self-concern. But where you're just carried out of yourself into the needs of the situation. And you just respond. And when that happens, it's a very deeply satisfying sense of rightness, appropriateness. It's very significant that, and I think I did say this last time, but since Samoga City is there, I'll say it now. While we were speaking, because we speak together, he and I are so much in tune while we're speaking, that we both of us experienced ourselves entering that state. We were simply speaking out of the audience, as it were. It's a remarkable moment, and others noticed that mood between us. And in fact, it's a hit program on Lord Buddha TV. In Nagpur, actually the whole of Maharashtra, there's a television channel called Lord Buddha TV, which has probably a small audience maybe 10 million people. And Amoga City and I are very well known. But of course we don't care. We're not interested in from our own sense. We're not talking about something that's sort of extraordinary in a certain sense, even though it is extraordinary. We're talking about something intensely human. We're not talking about suddenly hearing voices. I mean, you know, that could be how it happens, but it's something quite ordinary. In the midst of your ordinary experience, you forget yourself. You forget your own concerns, and you just enter into what's needed. And the feeling is that something is moving through you. That's how it feels, or how it may feel. You know, different people will interpret that experience in different ways. But you may feel that you're being sort of even guided or directed. You couldn't say exactly where from. Because from the point of view of your personal self-identification, it's from somewhere else, if you see what I mean. We're so used to always guiding our experience from our will. I do this. I go here. I say that. The experience of appropriate action, intelligent, aware action, which is not ultimately based in I, it doesn't sort of fit into our usual categories of thought. Of course, we know moments of being carried away in the not so healthy way. You know, I don't know what overcame me when I shouted at you. I just got something took me over. That's how it feels sometimes, isn't it? You're suddenly just find yourself in a rage. Oh, maybe you don't. You just suddenly find that you can't help yourself. You say those words, don't you? I couldn't help myself. I didn't mean to, but I did it. So we have that sort of experience of, as it were, loss of self, which is more on the level of giving way to the irrational, elements of self that have not been incorporated into your self-identity, you know, kind of assert themselves, you know, sort of, those lovely examples of Freud, of Protestant ministers who get up to preach and all that they can say is damn, damn, damnity, damn. I really enjoyed that one. So some sort of corner of the psyche which is not really integrated, you know, pushes through your conscious self-identity. We're not talking about that. The experience isn't like that of your normal self-identity being crushed or destroyed or pushed aside. We're talking about something in which you feel completely in tune as a self, but which is not self. So that you find yourself acting, you feel completely able to go along with your action, so to speak, if you even think about it. But it's not coming from your will. And the Buddha argued that this is what starts to happen when you follow through karmic evolution. These sort of states will begin to arise, especially if you engage in full practice in the sense that we'll talk more about tomorrow. So as we begin to evolve ourselves, as we begin to modify the way in which our experience arises, emerges, it emerges with more and more sort of space, less and less fixed, less and less held hard. And into that, or out of that, or some preposition to it, something arises that is not to do with that. And the Buddha argued that this can become your permanent mode of functioning. You can, in his phrase, enter the stream of the Dharma, so that you are entirely able to allow something to flow through you that is not I. This is a metaphor. When I say something, I'm not referring to an eternal entity. It's poetic language for the way in which you experience it. But you let something flow through you. That's your experience. You don't make it flow. It just comes. Probably creative experience, aesthetic or artistic creation would be a good analogy where the, I've had this experience of a poem just forming in my mind without any desire for it. Washing my hands. There's a line. And that's interesting, quite a nice line. Then there's another line. Then there's another. I'm sure Maitreya Bando experiences this all the time. A very rare experience for me. So that's an analogy. It's not exactly the same thing, because not necessarily exactly the same thing. But where moral action flows out of you without any volition. And this is the middle way. The middle way is directed to bringing about these states of mind which arise spontaneously out of your previous, out of the conditions that you brought about, and which give life its meaning and value. So, we've got a few minutes, and although I could just carry on seamlessly into another flow of exposition, perhaps I've said enough just to prime a few questions. So is anything I've said that sparks off some puzzlement? I hope there is. Yes.
Speaking as an eternalist, I can't see how you can get away from having to choose either eternalism or nihilism. You mentioned, you spoke of the flow of existence and mentioned the word unending twice. Do you think that existence is unending, i.e. eternal, or does it, you mean at some distant point it will end, we all die, ultimately,
nihilism? Well, of course, these are large philosophical problems that I would attempt to summarise as best I understand. I would recommend a reference to Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, which probably decisively deals with these questions, what he called the antinomies of reason. That when you abstract from the undifferentiated flow of experience, you already falsify. As soon as you start to speak in terms of a beginning and an end, you've imposed upon your experience an idea. And the problem for Buddhism with eternalist views is not the experiences that those views are about. As I said yesterday, some of those experiences would be very much common to us. It's the way in which those are thought about, and the consequences that come from thinking about them in those ways. So in Buddhism, we refer back simply to the flow of conditioned arising. We're not concerned with the beginning of that process or the end of it. We're simply saying that independence on this, that arises. So we don't say that there's something outside this which makes it arise, nor do we say that there is a nothing, as it were, within which they take place. So the issue is a quite complex philosophical one, and very difficult to speak with and avoid.
Are you saying then that we should believe in the conditions as the source of the flow, or this thing which is beyond us, which can overcome us and overtake us? Mm. It's not something outside, and it's not us, but it's some this other little way.
Yes.
Think with belief and faith.
I'm sorry. Think with.
With belief and faith, I look for something which will protect me, or I feel a source of love from, or which gives me reassurance, and that comes with thinking of a god or something outside.
Right. Yeah.
And how can you have that concept of faith? This middle way.
Right. Well, in Buddhism, let's say that source of value and meaning and purpose and, well, therefore reassurance and love is focused upon what arises out of the processes of karma. That as you develop yourself through karma, there arise states of mind which are of a quite different order, and in which all your problems are resolved. But we'll talk more about this tomorrow. I can see where you're coming from, I think. What in Buddhism, the initial basis, if you like, of faith is a confidence in the processes of karma. So you need to be confident, and you can base this in your experience, that if you act skillfully, that is on the basis of love, friendliness, of generosity, and of awareness, your own inner experience will be more and more satisfying, and more fulfilling, more truthful, more and more in tune. So initially, you need confidence in that, and you can refer to your experience. You can see the way in which this happens. And of course, mutatis mutandis, it's the other way around. If you act with unskillful mental states, you'll experience a decay of mind. So initially you need to have confidence in that. But you also need to have, to the extent that that's possible, a sort of provisional recognition that beyond karma is a flow of states, which are supra-selfish, and which are the deeper resolution of the problems of life. And it is very important, really, from a Buddhist point of view, that one deepens one's confidence in karma. If you really have confidence in karma, when you sit down to meditate and you make the effort to develop the skillful states that you're directed to, well, you'll do it more wholeheartedly, and then you'll get better results. And it's also increasingly important that you recognise that the whole Buddhist enterprise is directed to transcending, ultimately, self. and to have some confidence in that.
There's a question about consciousness in a sort of slightly roundabout way. Something that I find interesting is that sort of various things in science, various relatively recent developments in science and physics have possibly started to come to some kind of consensus with certain things that various spiritual traditions have talked about for thousands of years. And one of those is, you know, this idea that what we like to think of as reality, rather than being this sort of fixed, immutable thing, which may be more to do with illusions created by the limits of our perceptions, actually has, you know, like you said, this kind of this flow underlying it, this kind of open-ended state of flux and a possible sort of indivisibility between all things at sort of a smaller level. And Buddhism talks about sort of conditions and conditions based on conditions, and things like quantum physics talk about.
Can I hurry you up a little bit, because we're getting tight. Can we come to the question? Yeah.
I mean, one of the things was that quantum physics talks about, say, everything could exist potentially as either, for example, a wave or a particle, but it requires an observer to bring this into being. Without this, things dissolve back into this kind of open-ended state of flux. So it seems that the consciousness, rather than just shaping our experience of existence, might actually have a more fundamental role in existence itself. And I was wondering, is that something that sort of Buddhism talks about, and what your opinions might be on that?
Yeah, I'm afraid there's not a 2-minute answer for that one. But there's a huge, there's a huge potential area of discussion there. Maybe I'll try and touch on that a bit tomorrow, if I can get my consciousness up there. But clearly there is a Buddhism, it has a lot to say about the nature of consciousness. We're at the back there, yeah.
Yes, so it's about the way Buddhism is not really the same as Italianism, that there's a distinction. Because I remember that Zangrachi at one point was slightly troubled when a monk had presented him with a letter from a Christian authority saying that Buddhism is, without any doubt, an excellent human religion. And of course, he thought this was very good and was praising it, but Sangharakshita actually felt, well, it's actually sort of undermining. Well, I was just thinking that, as you said yesterday, that the Buddha said, no, I'm not a human. Perhaps to describe Buddhism purely as a human religion is, that's not really
Yeah, well, of course, it was no less a person than the Pope. And and if you know anything about Catholic theology, it was a very polite put-down. Because for it to be a human teaching is to say that it's really not up to merit. But it's a very polite way of saying it. Yes, it clearly is an important issue, because Buddhism is not merely a humanism. This is the point I was making yesterday, that Nietzsche interpreted Schopenhauer as arguing for, or that the end result of Schopenhauer's teaching being what he called a Western Buddhism. And he understood by Western Buddhism a sort of sanitized nihilism, a decent, honourable English sort of nihilism, in the John Major sense of English. that is much to be feared. May the Lord protect us from the gentle sound of leather on willow, unless it's in Delhi. Do you see what I mean? That I think that a lot of interpretation, early interpretation of Buddhism in the West, was as a sort of a very intelligent form of humanism. Certainly the early translators, people like Rhys Davids and so forth, who've contributed so much, they were really attracted to Buddhism, because they thought of it as even better than Protestantism in being highly rationalistic. And that, I think, has been quite a danger for modern Buddhism, that it simply becomes a decent human teaching. And, you know, better a decent human teaching than no teaching. But Buddhism has something more than that. It has in it this idea of transcendence of self-clinging, which it makes you something more than a human being. This is what I'm really trying to get at here. And I'll try to go into a bit more tomorrow. I'll try to not... I won't paraphrase tomorrow. I'll try and plunge more directly into this area. But that is the point, why Sangharakshita, you know, pointed out the problems in what the Pope said. And of course, he was very concerned to make this point, because the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, which is the descendant of the Inquisition, had noticed that there's a huge growth in views amongst Southern Catholics that are more like Buddhism. This is quite explicitly recognised by Cardinal Ratzinger, as he was. So it's a key issue. Buddhism is not merely a humanism. That's a nihilism. But it doesn't posit an eternal entity. It simply argues that there are states, conditioned arisings that transcend self-clinging. But there is an end to this session.